And he said he started reading your book as a skeptic, and he was won over. And I can see why, George. It's a wonderful book. It's a touching book. But I want to start with a reflection. You arrive here as a stateless refugee. You don't have citizenship. You've escaped from war-torn Greece. And then you get mixed up with all the wrong sorts. Communists, ANC people, resistance fighters, WIT students. And my reflection is this, George, that you turned 90 last year. I was at the celebration. It was a wonderful event at the Ananda Club with many hundreds of people. You have achieved what Macbeth says one should have in old age: honor, love, obedience, troops of friends. But you never knew that. In the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, you could never have known that you would be sitting at the Stellenbosch Woordfeest as one of its most honored authors.
Yes. I was involved in student politics in 1948. I had gone to WITS, first year BA. My father wanted me to become a doctor, but my marks were E's and D's, and I wasn't accepted.
And the E for Afrikaans.
E in Afrikaans. Also in English. And you know why? The English teacher at Athlone was a Scot and a communist. And his speech, "Man is born free, but it's everywhere else in
chains."
And the paper on English was, "Man is born free, but is everywhere in chains." And I decided that I would write an essay on that in my matric. I got an E. I think if you could manage it, he would probably have failed me. I had to write a supplementary examination in English with a very good tutor, and my entry into WITS was conditional to my doing much better in the new examination. And to my pleasant surprise, the new English examination was a solid, you probably know it, "Margaret, are you grieving over the golden groves unleafing? Are you grieving over this? Are you grieving over that? Are you grieving over the other?" And the final line, "Margaret, it is Margaret that you are grieving for." And in the supplementary examination, I discuss this sonnet. I got a B.
Well, we're very glad you did, George.
Yeah.
Because you went on to graduate as a lawyer, to serve on the WITS SRC, And one of the things that I never knew, and I've never asked you, even though we've been associated, I met you at the end of 1982 when I started at the bar. You were never a communist, that emerges from the book, and you were never a member of the ANC. Mandela asked you, you were one of his closest friends, he asked you to help draft the Constitution, and you said to him, do I have to join? And he said, no. So you never had a party affiliation, but you had a profound commitment to justice.
Yes. A week after Nelson Mandela was released, I got a call from our president. George Nelson wants Arthur Chaskelson and you to join the committee that's writing the Constitution.
George, could you be explicit? You are talking about the Honorable C.R.
Arthur Chaskelson.
You said Cyril Ramaphosa called you.
Yes.
Yes.
And I said, does that mean that we have to take a card? He said, no, we don't need your 12 rand. He knew that neither Arthur Chaskelson nor I would become members of any party or any organization because of the rules of our profession, that if you are representing them, you must be neutral and not unduly left to do what is expected to you, of you. And I said, but what do they exactly have to do, Cyril? He said, well, you have to help write the Constitution. And what else do we have to do? He said, nothing really. I said, nothing? Well, you may have to dance to the
toy.
I'll try and get you an exemption from toy.
George, I want to pause there because we have an Afrikaans audience and we have a deep contestation in our country about our past. And you quote Mandela as saying that apartheid was a moral genocide. And you yourself say that you refer to it as the plunder of the spirit that was the essence of apartheid. And I'm pausing there, George, because in terms of body counts and blood flown, apartheid wasn't, if you're counting bodies, apartheid was not the biggest atrocity on the African continent by any means. But your book helps us understand again why it was seen as a moral genocide, a crime against humanity, the plunder of the spirit that you referred to. And of course, when you were asked to help with the Constitution, we had just come to the formal renunciation of apartheid. That was 28 years ago.
Yes, I find myself concerned not only for what Afrikaners may feel, but what Nelson Mandela said was nothing new. In the Freedom Charter, There is a, which in 56, South Africa belongs to all who live in it. By 6,000 representatives in Kliptown, this was made part of the Freedom Charter. And Nelson Mandela insisted that we should put that South Africa belongs to all those who live in it. If I may, the secret discussion between Nelson Mandela in Paulsmoor prison and Minister of Justice Kutsia from Brandfort, where Winnie was.
Kwabi.
Kwabi visited Nelson at the hospital where he was recuperated. He asked Nelson was whether there was any possibility of the two sides coming together and having a decent state. He said, Kutsia said, that his president Botha didn't know that he was talking to Nelson about this.
And you recount a very long plane journey where you were asked to come up to the front and sit next to Justice Minister Kwabi Kutsia. The plane got diverted to Durban because of thunderstorms, so it turned into a five-hour conversation at a very crucial time in the tentative contacts between the ANC and the apartheid government.
Yes, this is quite right. Kwabi Kutsia is, if I may say so, a good man. I don't know whether he's still alive or not.
Kan hier nog iemand vir ons sê? Hy is wel. Het hy oorlei? Ja. He's passed away.
We had 5 hours on the plane because it went to Durban. He was trying to draw out of me, knowing that I was a regular visitor to Nelson Mandela and the others in the newly formed United Front, and he wanted to know how far is the majority of the people prepared to go in order to really come to terms. He asked questions. He told me that his president didn't know what he was doing. I didn't believe it, but nevertheless, I understood his position. I was worried. If Botha did not know about this, and I went to Zambia to talk to Oliver Tambo at the request of Nelson Mandela, it may be the good security police will be waiting for me and said, hey, where have you been? You spent a couple of days with Oliver Tambo. What about it? And I took a precaution. Johann Krichler was a clerk to Judge Steyn and Rumpf.
This is Judge Elsie Steyn, who later became Chief Justice in Bloemfontein. And Johan Krichler, may I just say, while we must flatter our audience as well, a number of portraits emerge in your book, George, of the fundamental decency of many Afrikaner people. And you've mentioned Kobie Coetzee. Johan Krichler, of course, is a giant. He's still living. We're very fortunate. He's still a giant in the struggle for justice. But you mention a number of fundamentally decent people upon whose virtues we were able to try to make our transition.
Well, I went to Johan and I told him what Nelson told me to do with Oliver and my discussion with Coetzee. I wanted him to join me for an afternoon, Saturday afternoon meeting with Coetzee at his home. Would he please come? He said, oh yes, of course. And we went. Coetzee was pleased that one of their number became involved, because Johan had been elected the chairman of Lawyers for Human Rights.
He was very outspoken.
Very outspoken.
And very Afrikaans.
To the hill. Because he actually took the oath by becoming an advocate. I was refused citizenship for 35 years. It only came about when 20 of the 22 judges learned that I was refused citizenship. And one of their number, Galgut, went to Foster and said, what is this that George Bezos applies for citizenship and you don't give it to him? Galgut found me.
This is Oscar Galgut, who was later a judge of appeal in Bloemfontein, and after he retired at 75, he stayed on for 10 or 12 years, deep into his 80s, as a wing member of the court.
Yeah.
And he was known as a tough old critter, but he reached out to you, and again for reasons of fundamental decency.
Yes.
And said, go to Home Affairs, take photographs, you'll get your citizenship.
Well, what happened was that Jules Brodie, who was a very, he's passed away, a well-known member of the bar, told me that he was going to Greece. I had not been to Greece in 72 when he came to me. And I said, you must go and see my mother. He went. He came back. He told me, I can't understand, George, what your mother told me through an interpreter in the restaurant that she took us to. I asked her, how often does George come to the village? And my mother said, since he left in 1941, this was 72, he hasn't been back. Jules came and told me, what the hell is wrong with you? A beautiful village by the sea, olive trees, pear trees, this, that, and the other. We spent a wonderful week in the village. And here your mother tells me that you haven't been there at all. I told Jules the reason, that I feared that if I took a Greek passport, the door would be closed behind me. A week later, on the phone, Judge Calgett. George, you bloody fool. What have I done now, Judge? Jules came to tell me what is going on with your life. I called the 22 judges of the Transvaal Provincial Division to tell them about your plight. 20 of the 22 said that I must go to Foster, tell him that it is manifestly unfair that a young lawyer who defends Nelson Mandela and Bram Fischer and others, and who is respected by us as judges, should really be treated the way he is, as a pariah, and not given citizenship. He told me you must take a Greek passport. That stopped him and said, no, that will not do. He leads a South African life. He is married. He has children. You have to really treat him what he deserves. Foster gave in. He said, okay, let him take a laissez-passer, come back, apply for citizenship, guaranteed to be given, true to his word, that happened. And as I mentioned, Ron Fisher. You know, perhaps you should take what I'm about to tell you, should take a little trip. During the Rivadia trial, the head was Bram Fischer, Arthur Chaskelson, Vernon Berenger, Joel Joffe, and I were the lower class. I drove Bram in his car from his house in the northern suburbs to a parking lot in Pretoria. When we were early, he said, George, instead of going up the steps at the back of the court, let's go around the front. I want to show you something at the foot of Paul Kruger statue. I want to test you as Afrikaners. What does it say? Do you know what Kruger said? And what is written at the bottom?
You quoted, George, in Dutch. Yeah.
Yes. In Dutch. And Bram translated with pride to me. As sure as the sun will rise in the morning, freedom will come to Africa. Not Boer freedom will come to Africa. And this is something that it was not only Johan Krichler and
Bram Fischer.
Bram Fischer. That thought the same. Many of the judges did the right thing.
You mention quite a few of them, George. You mention some to whom ignominy attaches, but you also mention a large number of judges, including Ramsbottom, H.C. Nicholas, and then, of course, Tos Becker.
Oh, Tos Becker.
Tos Becker, who was one of the panel that acquitted the first treason trial at the end of 1959, and then appeared in the mini Rivonia trial afterwards, and was a fundamentally decent human being.
Absolutely. He asked Nelson in the treason trial, when Nelson was in the box, "Mr. Mandela, you know, and we know what you have written, that you want of us whites to do. Are you prepared to accept something less of your demands, so that we can actually live together in peace and prosperity?" Nelson was quite open. Here I am in the witness box being cross-examined. I am sure that the whites of this country put something on the table, we will give it consideration, and we want to live together in peace. I can't give you any guarantee because I am alone in the witness box. This was an example. This was an example. Let me also tell you another story about Becker. A father and mother, black, from Natal, came to Nelson Mandela on a Saturday morning. To Oliver Tambo.
Yeah.
Early on a Saturday morning. Their son was going to be executed on Monday. They said that there was evidence that someone else had done the killing and not their son. Oliver came.
He was then an attorney in practice in partnership with Mandela.
Yes.
The most famous named law firm in the history of South Africa, Mandela and Tambo. So you took many, many briefs from Mandela and Tambo. You were kept busy.
Yes.
I'm sure that they paid for your modest flat in Emerentia with the briefs that you did. So Tambo then
briefs
you.
They were not that generous.
I'm sure you struggled, George. I know.
Yeah.
Because there weren't always fees for that sort of work.
I was also.
But it's an enthralling story, George. I don't want to divert you.
I was also very, very lucky to have married an artist with a degree in art. She was early more than me, the young advocate.
George, I deflected you. The mother and the son arrived from KwaZulu-Natal. There's an execution pending. Your attorney, Oliver Tambo, briefs you, and you travel in your car to Pretoria.
Yes.
For an urgent interdict for a stay of execution. And to me, that's one of the most telling and moving stories. There are many, many in the book, many beautiful and moving stories. But tell our audience what happens. You arrive at the judge's house because you need a stay and the court is not
yes.
in session.
We went to the court, the bell called White, by the way, told us that the duty judge was this Judge Becker. He phoned him to tell him that there was this application. The judge said, "Let him come to the house." Okay. Oliver Tambo, drove the car, and I went with Oliver, and Mr. White told us that when we arrived, and Oliver was going to accompany me into the home of George Becker, White said, "Hey, blacks can't go into the judges' houses. Stay in your car." Oliver was absolutely livid. But he said at the end, "George, you better go in alone. We are here to save a life."
George, and you sketch this picture on a Saturday afternoon in the suburbs of Pretoria, the Afrikaans suburbs of Pretoria. You, the judge, the Secretary of Justice, who at that stage was what we now call the Director General, having tea and crumpets in the judge's house while Oliver Tambo waits in your car. And when you come out, the only news is that the stay of execution has been granted, and he embraces you.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful picture.
Well, I see that you're a good reader. And you say it better than I remember it.
I shall not take over from here. George, I want to give our audience a good chance, because I think a lot of them have got questions for you. But I want to do a wrap-up. And let me say that when I started reading the book, I thought, here's young Bezos. The Jewish word is dafka, which means averse or perverse or obstinate. Here
cheeky.
You come, pardon?
Cheeky.
Cheeky, yeah. Cheeky, pig-headed. You come here as a penniless refugee, working in a cafe, living in a back room, qualifying at WITS. What do you embrace? You embrace equal rights for white and black. You embrace human dignity for all. You embrace organizational rights. And the thought I had was, what would a young George Bezos embrace today that might be unpopular and dangerous? And one of the notes I made, I thought, well, what about sex workers? What about animal rights? What about cross-border migrants? One of the notes I made was land. And right at the end of your book, I get to land, and you take a stand on the land debate. Your book was finished. It went to the printers before the current controversies. But I wonder if you could tell the audience what you say in that final chapter about the land question.
Well, I am concerned because I was part of the writing of the Constitution. There is a Section 25 with no less than 8 subsections of what the government ought to do in order that the justices of the injustices of the past can be cured. In 74, Section 74, there is also a long thing that the government is supposed to do. What has in fact happened is that except for some minor things done during Mr. Mandela's presidency, the South African government has done absolutely nothing to do a just distribution of the land in South Africa.
You join my former colleague, Deputy Chief Justice Moseneke, in lambasting governmental inefficiency and corruption in land redistribution.
I'm very pleased that a young man who spent 12 years on the island came out, became a great advocate, became a great judge, and as we say in the book, good friends.
He was your junior when you acted in the Winnie Mandela trial, but you acted with him on many occasions.
Oh, yes. Now, you know that generalizations are, who said it, are not to be taken seriously. And for people, particularly young people, to presently say that that whites are colonialists. On that basis, I'm a colonialist, but I don't think I am. And I don't think that the people of South Africa are colonialists.
The bottom line of your discussion is a warning to tread with dread caution on this issue. And the other thing you say is that the current provision in the Constitution makes ample provision for land justice without being tinkered with.
I tell you, there's land which is not used for the benefit of the people of South Africa. It belongs to somebody whose grandfather was a Boer and did there. He is now a businessman, particularly rich. He has this land. He may have a couple of bucks on it. Bucks, not money. He takes his friends to do a bit of shooting every Thursday, monthly. And he doesn't pay tax. He produces nothing. And section 25 says not that you can take it for nothing, but it certainly gives the door to actually take it away for very little, and he can go to court and say that it is too little or something like that. That has not happen at all. And for the idea of a farmer got this land for him in line from his great-great-grandfather. He produces corn, he has cows, goats,
lamb. I'm teasing you. George's favorite dish.
Yeah, lamb on the spit. Huh?
George, I want to ask a personal question. I said the last question was going to be my last, but there are a few poignant places where regrets appear. And I'm not going to ask you to speak about Duma Nokwe. He was the first black advocate in the country. He went into exile. You regret you never contacted him or his family out of fear. To me, that was an enormously poignant and instructive that a person as brave as you could be in fear of what the apartheid police might do if you contacted his family. I don't want to pause there, George. The question is this. You defended Winnie with some measure of success when she was accused of the abduction and beating of Stompy Sepe. And you mention something that was of great concern to me at that time as a gay man, which was the defense that Winnie asked you to run, which is that she abducted these boys because Paul Verrain, the Methodist pastor in Soweto, was sexually abusing them. And I, as a gay activist, was at that very time, 1991, struggling to secure equality for LGBTI people in the Constitution. So the defense you ran was a very grievous one to me. And I said so in public. I went on to carte blanche at the time to criticize what happened. But I want to ask you whether you speak a great deal about Winnie, and you speak of her sullied reputation, you speak of the grievous injury that she inflicted on Nelson with her extramarital affairs, her love affair with Dali and Porfu, which you speak about with great candor. My question is this, before we turn over to the audience, do you have regrets about running that defense in the Winnie kidnapping trial?
No, I think that the judge that had
Michael Stechman.
Stechman actually did not believe her and sentenced her to 6 months in prison. The Court of Appeal found that he was wrong. I think that the Court of Appeal was right, that the things that he found against her.
That was on the basis of Koliswa Fati's evidence.
Who was shown to be not a decent person or a truthful person.
Nor indeed, even on Judge Corbett's judgment in the appeal court, was Winnie shown to be a decent or truthful person.
Absolutely.
But let's leave it there, George. I want to give the last 15, 20 minutes to the audience. But Paul Verrain has, of course, also emerged. He's still working in Soweto 26 years, 28 years later, with his reputation intact. Yeah, and you accept that as well?
I accept that. I talked to him. I talked to him then. He didn't give evidence. I think that he was probably advised not to give evidence. I do not have anything against him, but I don't think that there was evidence that Willie was actually party to the murders. The trouble with Winnie was that she was very embittered, that she was not appointed the leader of the struggle by the UDF, which went to Mrs. Sisulu. She actually became involved with football players, some of whom, no doubt, did their duty to the authorities, because they actually beat up the children.
Acts of brutal thuggery. Yeah.
Thuggery.
Yeah.
And she actually, and they said that they were Mandela's
Football club,
which was nonsense.
George, may I pause there, because I'm anxious to give members of the audience a chance who want to pick your brain, ask questions. There must be things from the book that they might be interested in raising. May we turn over to them for some questions? Excellent. Thank you. You've been asked tougher questions in your life before. Dames en here, daar is geleentheid om vrae te stel aan ons gas. Is there anyone who wants to ask? Yes, I see a gentleman in the front. We've got a roving mic. I see that gentleman there. I see two questioners. Can I see a third? And then we'll take the three questions. I'll refresh both our memories. Is there a third question, or we have only two questions? We have only two. There's a third question right at the back. Is that the lady there? One, two, three. And then, George, I'm going to ask the questioners to state their names, to ask a question in a single sentence. And then I'm going to help us both to remember them. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Judge. Advocate George, the judge didn't say how long the sentence may be.
This part. But what is your name, asseblief?
Cornelis Lourens.
Uitstekend. Cornelis.
Ja.
Asseblief.
I want to know about the Rivonia trial, whether the fact that Advocate Bram Fischer was an Afrikaner played any role, whether there was any engagement amongst the advocates and the judge, the vet, and lastly, why did the state not charge the accused of treason in the alternative in terms of the Terrorism Act?
Dis een sin, baie geluk. Ja, meneer, hier op die rij. George, it's the Rivonia treason trial. Why were they not charged with treason? Did the fact that Bram was an Afrikaner play a part? And were there contacts between the defense team and the judge? But we'll first take the second and the third question, and then you'll get a chance to answer. Dankie, meneer. Yeah. Ja, meneer.
Ek is Johan de Jager, and I want to ask Mr. Bezos, me as a retired white Afrikaner, what should I do to be part of the solution amidst all that's happening around us?
Baie dankie, Johan. En dan die dame links agter, die laaste vraag.
Ek is Ansie de Tooy. I would like to know why you came to South Africa.
Would you like to start there, George?
What was that last?
Why time? South Africa? You're on a boat. You're escaping from war-torn Greece and the German occupation. And how do you end up in South Africa? Not India.
Yes.
Ons begin daarby, dan sal ons by Johan en Corneel se vrae nog uitkom.
Okay, I'll deal with it. But let me deal with the Rivonia trial. Bram Fischer was a leader of the bar. He was an Afrikaner. He was respected. He was a communist before the Communist Party was banned. He was in the team in the before the Rivonia trial with Easy Mazels, and he did, Brown did a wonderful job. He was a great advocate. He wasn't around when the Rivonia people were arrested. He came couple weeks later, after particularly Arthur Chaskelson and I had consultation with Walter Sisulu, Governor Mbeki, Cathedra, and others. Arthur Chaskelson was a lawyer's lawyer par excellence. He came back. Arthur Chaskelson was a member of his group. Arthur told him that he must lead the team. He was a man who respected his legal profession. He told Arthur and me that he did not want to be involved without telling us why. Arthur Chaskelson in particular said there are going to be death sentences. There is no lawyer in South Africa that can say what you can say about the death penalty, about the 10 years that was given to the Boers and so.
And General Christian de Wet.
De Wet. And said, if a person like yourself says it, the judge will have to give it the weight it's worth.
So the Afrikaner inslag, Cornelis, was in fact seen as pivotal.
Absolutely. And he eventually agreed to become the leader of the team. And we were his... he was respected by certainly the bar in the UK, where he appeared, particularly for mining houses and other cases.
Before the Privy Council.
Yeah. And he was persuaded that he would have to be the leader, and he was. And what happened was, I think, that his presence, in particular as the leader, led to what happened worldwide, that the people on trial were decent people that wanted liberty, they wanted equality, and I will never forget Brahm coming in his Volkswagen belonging to his daughter at 6 o'clock in the morning into the house. And he shouted at me, "Look, the United Nations passed a resolution that this trial should stop. Isn't that a great thing?" And of course, we took it up. And the world at large, from the Soviet Union to the United States, from the northern countries to Australia and New Zealand, people, and particularly young people at the universities, started calling for the release of the people. And all that, I think, was because of the integrity of Brahm Fischer, the Afrikaner.
George, thank you. I think we're not going to be able to give Cornelis a comprehensive answer, because I want to get to why South Africa and Johan de Jager's question. What should an honorable, committed person of the soil, who happens to be a white Afrikaner, what should that person be doing today to make things work, to contribute to a solution rather than to an obstruction?
He, the Afrikaner, is doing quite a lot. The primary school, less than 2 kilometers from our house, in the northern suburbs. 90% of the learners are black.
And they're being taught in Afrikaans.
And one of the subjects is Afrikaans. It was one of the better schools in the northern suburbs. If I may give it up a detail, we have a woman, black woman, working for us for the last 17 years. She had a child of 5 with her mother in Zululand. She brought it to our home, brought him a son. The majority in that school are black children. And a boy who couldn't speak a word of English got, in his third year, 92%, the top of the class.
He didn't get an E. George, we have to end, and I'm grateful for your response to Mr. De Jager, and I'm afraid we're not going to get to the question, why South Africa, not India? But I want to conclude. Your book at the beginning, in the prologue, says that Arthur Chaskalson died December 2012, Mandela December 2013. You speak about Kathy Kathrada, Nadine Gordimer, Jules Brody, and then very touchingly at the end of your book, 2 September 2017, your dearly beloved wife and partner over all these decades, Arite. And then you say, I beg that the bell will now toll for me. But I want to add something to that. That's the prologue. At the end, right at the end of your book, you said, I had a conversation recently with Mrs. Grasa Machel, and I told her that I wish the bell tolls for me. And she said, George, stop thinking about the bell tolling for you and think about the work you've still got to do. And she said, and stop crying, George.
Yes, well, you know that if I may permit it, I had a wife for 70 years. I went to Zambia, I went to Southwest Africa, went to Durban. I did this, I did that, I was away for months. So never once did my wife say, hey, you've got a home, you've got sons, 3 of them. What about spending some of the time at home? And of course I'm affected by it. But what I think is this, that there are too many Johann Krichlers now that were not there before. And I get upset when they say that they are whites. Because of that, they are colonists. To say to the great, great, great grandson or daughter of a white Afrikaner who is a teacher, a professor, an engineer, successful businessman. Hey, you were not one of us. We must take over. I think it's not what I say. It is what Nelson Mandela said, which I quote in the book. Not only the only one who says that South Africa belongs to all of us. I have always believed that. I know that the security police wanted very urgently to arrest me. But they failed. I think, and I may say, my two sons at Wits University were distributing pamphlets outside the station. A sergeant went to the younger Alexei and took him to the policeman. His elder brother was there as well with pamphlets. And my son Alexei said, "Damon, Damon, they taken me in." And Damon rushed to the... And the sergeant said, "You get into the van as well." They were taken to the 10th floor of John Foster Square. That's where Tibble was alleged to have jumped out of the window, and which we recently proved that he was actually murdered. They went there, and there was a brigadier, and asked the younger, "What's your name?" "Alexei Bezos." "And you, what's your name?" "Table Jesus." The brigadier, "Are you related to the lawyer?" "Yes." "You know, don't go and tell your father that we arrested you."
George, we have to end there. Our time is up.
Just by the thing. And he asked the brigadier, "Have you got a car in town?" "Yes, near the station." "Sergeant, take these gentlemen to their car."
Thank you, George. Thank you, dames en here. George.
And 2 weeks later, in a political case, the brigadier came up to me and said, "Morning, Mr. Bezos." "Good morning. How are the boys?" "Oh," I said, "is it you?" He said, "Yes." And I thought I would say, "You know, brigadier, if you treated everybody's children the way you treated all my children, would both have an easier life in the country." Keep it up.
Thank you. George Bezos, baie dankie dames en here vir 'n heuglike gesprek. Ons spreek ons waardering aan u uit. Thank you.